Welcome to the DNVGL Talks Energy podcast series. Electrification, rise of renewables and new technologies, supported by more data and IT systems, are transforming the power system. Join us each week as we discuss these changes with guests from around the industry.
Welcome to a new episode of DNVGL Talks Energy. My guests today are Tim Rockel, Director, Global Energy Institute from KPMG, as well as Sharad Somani, Partner, Global Infrastructure Advisory, also from KPMG. Welcome, Tim. Welcome, Sharad.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tim, maybe we start with you. For both of you, I would like you to introduce yourself before we start and also explain a little bit what are you doing in KPMG.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so my name's Tim and I'm the director of the Global Energy Institute for KPMG. And my role is to make sure that we've got the Asia Pacific angle reflected in all the work that we do from Houston to Europe and that our clients understand what's going on in this region. So it's a two-way street. I've been in Singapore for 5 years. Before that, I was based in the Middle East and used to speak to Saudi Aramco quite a lot, based out of Bahrain, and before that in London. But my career has primarily been in the energy sector. And since being in Singapore, we've been heavily involved in the Singapore International Energy Week. We've now been involved in five SUs, and that's 50% of them. And we're very pleased with the way that the themes have developed and the conversations that are going on under this roof here in Singapore.
Right, thank you. Thank you very much. Sharad, could you also tell us briefly about yourself?
Sure. I lead the infrastructure project finance practice for KPMG, primarily covering Southeast Asia as a market and a little bit in the Middle East as well. The primary focus that we have is in the area of power and utilities, covering traditional power, coal, gas, and renewable energy. And we do also waste to energy, energy efficiency projects in the region. The kind of work that we do is both with the governments and the private sector, helping them structure projects, get financing, and essentially organize public-private partnerships.
Right. So having the benefit of having you both here in this episode, I would be keen that we cover maybe a little bit the importance of gas going forward in the energy mix and also some related finance issues with regards to gas, but maybe also with regards to renewables. But to get us started, Tim, you just came from a panel you moderated on the Singapore International Energy Week. So it would be great if you could maybe share with us what were the main findings in that panel discussion around gas.
Sure, yeah, and Gas Asia kicked off today. So today is Wednesday, and during the earlier part of the week, we heard a lot about renewables and big advocacy going on in renewables, people very positive, and I think, you know, the fossil fuels were slightly shut out. Yesterday, we saw a few more statistics from the International Energy Agency showing, you know, that coal and particularly gas is going to be an important part of the mix going forward. And if you look at countries like Thailand, here in Singapore, gas is a really important part of the mix. But when, you know, the panel I was on today, you know, Indonesia was there. And when you look at maps of Indonesia and the infrastructure that's required, there's a lot of head scratching going on because there's, you know, the energy capacity build out is going from something like 166 million tons of oil equivalent today to over 1,000 in 2050. And just that, they need all options. So they're going to need renewables. It's not going to get them all away. They're going to need gas. But of course, in this region, you've got the decline of gas. So very much we were talking today about the role of the buyer. And so you've got the American producers now offering fixed prices at kind of $6. Some you know, originally it was 8 earlier in the year, but that number's now coming down to 6. And so people are looking at kind of what are all the options? And I think we'll talk a bit later on as well around how does gas get into the mix? How does it sit alongside renewables? Battery storage coming in as well. So is it kind of gas? Is it battery? But then still coal. You can still produce coal at to international standards, and with the amount of coal in this part of the world, you know, that's being discussed as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. So you mentioned gas. Slightly resources are going down in the region. We have, at some parts in the region, a lot of coal, but it's very difficult to finance any new coal projects. So when I put that together, we have a lot of investments to come for gas for the different countries here. We will have to import, at least in this part of the world. And on the other hand, we cannot do much with the coal going on because coal projects find that difficult to find finance. Maybe, Sharad, you could elaborate on this aspect a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamics. I mean, one statistic that came out from CU yesterday was, for the first time globally, the total investments going to power sector has surpassed oil and gas sector. We effectively mean that people are investing more in traditional power and renewable energy in aggregate in terms of total investments, which I think will only increase going forward given the fact that there's a huge power requirement in this region specifically. I mean, you look at the electrification rate in Myanmar is just about 25%. Indonesia wants 35 gigawatt in the next 5 years, so it's a huge, huge requirement. Now, I think what is happening is coal is getting a bit constrained, primarily because a lot of banks are shying away from coal projects. That is not to say that coal will not happen. Out of the 35 gigawatt that Indonesia is talking, at least 40% will still be coal, but they will do a clean coal, which is supercritical coal. It is also interesting to note that Middle East has done coal as well as part of their fuel diversification strategy. So we have got around 2.4 gigawatt projects under development in Dubai as well. When it comes to financing challenges, I think gas projects have a challenge given the fact that the domestic gas is limited in this region. You have to necessarily have LNG terminals, LNG import terminals developed to get the financing going. And if you look at the kind of LNG contracts which were signed till date, it's a long-term take-or-pay kind of commitments, which not very many governments are becoming comfortable as yet. I mean, governments like, you know, Indonesia, Myanmar, Malaysia will take some time to get their head around long-term LNG contracts, which is in a way also prompting on the supply side, on the LNG side, to look at a shorter-term contracts, which is happening and which is good news for the power sector in this region. On the renewable side, I think I would say that when you look at the strategy of most of these countries, they have gas as a necessary component, and all these countries in the region are looking at 20 to 25% of their portfolio coming through renewable energy, which is a great thing because look at the renewable potential in the region, solar, wind and geothermal, there's a fair bit of potential. Solar, of course, is leading the way. Mini hydro, we are getting a number of projects happening, run of the river type, which are environmentally quite friendly. And given this four sectors kind of contributing, we are seeing a number of good financings happening. Now, the interesting thing about renewable is, unlike a big gas fired project or LNG terminal, the renewable projects are typically smaller, you're looking at 30, 50, 100 megawatt kind of range, which is easy to finance. The challenge essentially in these countries is, of course, regulatory, environmental and land related issues, which I must say are falling in place, but it's not happening at the pace that we would expect. Countries like Indonesia have come out with very clear regulations around land acquisitions. There's a very clear mandate around regulated tariff for renewable. So I believe that once there are certain proof of concepts happen in each of the sectors on terms of projects, then financing will come in.
Right. I would like to come back to the financing aspect a little bit later. Sure. The NVGL has just also launched the Energy Transition Outlook, and we see that gas is the single kind of largest source of energy also going ahead. But as we also mentioned maybe in this discussion already, renewables are growing very strong. We expect that the electricity demand will grow by about 140% up to 2050 due to the electrification of different industries like transport and heat, but that 72% of that electricity will be generated by renewables. So we see there's certainly a competition between gas and renewables. We sometimes call it the frenemy, the friend and the enemy. So I would like to elaborate maybe a little bit on how these two can play together, the gas and the renewables. Maybe if you'd like to share sure. your views.
I think both have to coexist. I mean, given the intermittent nature of the renewable energy, you cannot take renewable energy beyond a certain level. I mean, typically, based on some of the technical studies we have looked at, not more than 25% of the grid can be sustained by renewable unless you bring a massive amount of storage. Now, as you see, the battery storage is still very, very expensive. Over the next 5 to 10 years, we expect the battery storage will become competitive. But gas will have to continue to provide a peaking load as well as base load in some instances going forward. So if you look at a typical mix, the countries are trying to look at, if nuclear is an option, they'll have nuclear as a base load. Coal, if you have excess and some old plants, and it'll continue to operate coal as a base load. Gas will be with the peaking load, and then renewable energy will be taking care of the difference. One of the things that most countries have to do when they chart out their strategy on portfolio of energy supply options, they have to essentially ensure that gas continues to be a critical component because it helps provide the necessary risk diversification, both domestic gas as well as international gas. So Singapore is doing that. Singapore has got piped natural gas coming from Malaysia and Indonesia, but they have LNG terminals also developed. The second thing is renewable energy in Singapore. In fact, we are talking of 1 gigawatt of renewable energy. So that will almost be 10% of our total installed capacity So renewable in Singapore itself, given the size constraint, is still a creditable achievement. But if you look at countries like Philippines, where is huge geothermal potential, Indonesia with both geothermal and solar and mini hydro, all three together, this will continue to coexist. So it is not either or, it's probably gas and renewable, which has to happen.
Yeah, so this was not exactly what I wanted to talk about at the beginning, but since you just mentioned that, you also had nuclear in there.
Yes.
And I think we had a very ambitious colleague here also on Sioux, who was trying to push that industry forward and admitted that he has a problem maybe to make the right advertisement for it because there's a perception issue about nuclear. So maybe Tim, what would be your view on this? I mean, even the Japanese colleagues tell us they have trouble with promoting nuclear in Japan. What will happen to that industry?
Yeah, I mean, that came up on the panel as well today. And of course, you know, the kind of nuclear switch on in Japan, you know, post Fukushima is still an issue. So there are a number of plants now which are ready to come on, more that are being ready for approval. And some of the stats that we saw today was showing that, you know, Japanese imports have probably peaked, and so of gas because of the renewables coming back on board. So that then changes the whole dynamics as well. So you've got the gas buyers in Japan looking to place that gas somewhere else because they're overcontracted. So what they're looking to do now is, you know, to remove destination clauses from contracts, go towards a shorter contracts that Sharad has mentioned, but also look for destinations for that gas in Southeast Asia. So we're seeing a number of the Japanese players now looking to kind of place that by investing in power and other assets in the region, which I think is going to be really useful. And I think you summed it up quite nicely, Sharad. When I think of gas, I always put the word and, so after the end. So yeah. Gas, you know, and renewables, gas and transport.
Right.
And the good thing is that here in Singapore, you've kind of got gas and talent. So you've got a number of big gas players based here. There's going to have to be a shift in the kind of skills of that talent as well. So if you look at the traditional companies, the larger companies, very good at building the mega projects, very good at dealing with national governments, very good at securing rights. If we're looking at the gas and renewables angle, very different skills. You're dealing with more, you know, smaller regional governments. You're looking at securing land access rights. You're looking at building small pipelines, and not all these projects are bankable. So you've got the kind of the talent, the negotiation side, you've got then the bankability of these projects. We know that there's money out there, but the projects aren't always bankable. So different funders are looking for different things from these projects. And that's something we've been working with everyone from pension funds to private equity on.
Right, that actually leads me nicely into my finance questions again, what you just said at the end. So one thing we pick up is that banks, insurers and reinsurers are approaching us having trouble to assess risk of some of the projects coming up here in the region. And so in case of DNVGL, it's especially offshore wind where they have trouble because the assessment or maybe project certification regime is very different from the markets they're used to work in, like, for example, Europe. So maybe that's a question for you, Sharad. How do you see that? What can we do to make banks, insurers, reinsurers more comfortable to invest?
Yeah, I think a fair bit needs to be done because increasingly the region is quite reliant on ECA's financing. You know, not very many commercial banks are coming and funding projects. It's not only about the renewables, also the traditional projects are quite dependent on Exim banks coming and giving guarantees to make projects happen. There are a few challenges, and I think there's an institutional framework being put together. The challenges being most of the projects don't have a very well-defined path to development. And very, very sophisticated projects like Central Java IPP in Indonesia took around 5 years from conceptualization to financial close. And this is something which very few investors have appetite to wait for. If you look at what's happening in other smaller projects, increasingly they are depending on either Exim guarantees or some kind of corporate support, meaning that the sponsors providing support.
Mm-hmm.
Now this of course cannot continue for bigger projects because there's only so much corporate support can be offered. Indonesia has specifically come up with what they call as the Indonesia Infrastructure Guarantee Fund, which effectively guarantees some of the sovereign obligations on the projects, which is making some institutional investors comfortable. I don't think that's a complete solution, but it's a good start. Then there's a new entity which has been set up, is a credit guarantee and investment facility, which has been set up in Philippines through ASEAN plus three governments. And the idea is to guarantee issuance of local currency bonds for projects. Now, that's one market that has been totally untapped in the region, where there's no capital market support for infrastructure. There's no institutional investors who are supporting infrastructure financing. So the pool of financing available for infrastructure projects is only for commercial banks and ECAs, Exim banks. Once you open the tap from insurance companies, institutional investors, private equity houses, infrastructure funds, and capital markets, I think that will be a huge boost to the infrastructure financing. The real challenge for that is how do you get credible projects? Now, credible projects can be split into two parts. One is a good development phase, and second is good operation. I think development risk, to my mind, in the foreseeable future, will still have to rely on ECAs and commercial banks. On the operating side, I think capital markets are becoming comfortable. The business trust model started in Singapore has been reasonably successful. A lot of infrastructure projects in operation phase have been put as a dividend yield play on the business trust. So that's a good solution for operating phase projects. There is also a concept which has been introduced in Singapore recently is the fact that you can do a takeout financing, meaning that once the construction is completed and project is commissioned, the takeout institution will come and buy out the banks which had funded the development. So effectively that frees up the bank funding for potentially investing in new projects. The other interesting thing which we should look out for is privatization of assets. I think a lot of governments in the regions, particularly Indonesia, has recognized that greenfield projects takes a long time and it's a dampener on the spirit of investment by the private sector. What they are proposing is they're offering a few projects from PLN or Pertamina or the road sector, all the sectors, effectively privatizing existing assets, which are easy to fund because you know the operational track record is immediately generating funds. And that, to my mind, will be a great opportunity for all investors and lenders in the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay. There's a second aspect which I would like to throw some light on, and I'm afraid we are then slowly also coming already to the end of this episode, but we are hearing about the importance of renewables going forward. We are hearing about them becoming cheaper and cheaper, especially now also in the auction system. But I'm also talking to equity investors, for example, who are a little bit concerned about the yield rates they can get out of these projects, because obviously finance has to become cheap as well. So there are some ideas, I think we discussed before we started recording here, about hybrid projects, renewables and gas maybe to get together, so to bundle things to make them bigger, the projects more attractive. But so where's this going? Are we going into a deadlock in renewables financing because the yield rates are not attractive?
So it's a very good point, and I think we require some recalibration of expectations on all sides. I think the governments are thinking that the prices have to keep going on and the interest rate have to be very, very attractive. I think if you see last 6-7 years, we have been in a low interest rate environment for a long time, but the expectations of the equity investors have not been recalibrated. We worked on a few projects and we closed 3 projects in the Middle East recently, and most of these projects closed at single digit return for equity investors, which effectively means that if the project is reasonably certain, the technology is reasonably established and risks are contained, you can't expect supernormal returns in those projects. You know, when Thailand implemented solar projects 5 years back, they had some very good returns. But if you look at the most recent auction that happened in Malaysia on solar, 30 to 50 megawatt, mostly were single digit or low double digit kind of returns. So effectively, when we talk to private equity houses, infrastructure funds, we are actually suggesting to them that if the project is certain and risks are contained, we may have to recalibrate our equity return expectations. And that's the only way you can get into projects.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for that outlook. I have one last question for both of you before we close. And that would be, what is your main takeaway from the Singapore International Energy Week 2017, Tim?
Yeah, well, I think once again, the organisers have really hit the nail on the head. But what really struck me was the conversations around energy access. That seems to be a part of a lot of the sessions now. This part of the region, we know the potential. Still 100 million people can't switch on a light bulb. But people are talking about that, they're measuring it, and they're now predicting that we will get to 100% access in the next couple of decades. And that, for me, is going to have enormous impacts on GDP. It doesn't just increase the GDP because you're bringing more people into the economy, but also for the people who currently have, there's a lot more marketplace for them. So I see energy as an enabler of GDP as well. And the other thing that's being talked about, and it's now being measured for the first time by International Energy Agency, is digitization. So this whole leapfrogging of technology, we've seen it in telecoms, I think we'll see it in electricity and power as well. So a lot of the people who haven't currently got electricity probably will never see an electricity bill. They might not even have a bank account, a physical bank that they're going to pay for their bill. It'll all be done on mobile. So I think this digitization is very exciting for the region. I think you're going to see innovation created here. But the big thing for me is this energy access and the transparency that is now talked about as a part of the main theme of the conference.
Right, great. Yeah, exciting times ahead, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, probably three big takeaways for me. I think one is renewable energy will continue to play a very, very important role. And there's a lot of bullishness amongst all the players, utilities, developers, bankers about it. Second is, I think microgrids will play a very, very important role going forward. And same to Tim's point about access. Microgrids will increasingly play an important role together with renewable to take an electricity to remote parts of the region. And Cambodia was a great example where the minister was talking about renewable energy giving access to electricity. And third is, of course, innovation and digitization is going to help leapfrog the sector. And we do expect a fair bit of potentially disruption happening where new players will come and make electricity available to the masses.
Very good. So, Tim, Sharad, thank you very much for your very valuable insights and for your time. And to the listeners out there, thank you very much for listening in. That were Tim Rockel, Director, Global Energy Institute, as well as Sharad Somani, Partner, Global Infrastructure Advisory from KPMG.
Thank you for listening to this DNVGL Talks Energy podcast. To hear more podcasts in the series, please visit dnvgl.com/talksenergy.